No, Latimer, crop circles are man-made. I'm sure they proved that years ago. Didn't farmers make them using planks and string?
That was just a cover story spun by the media to hide the truth, Mum. It's one of the few things Hollywood has got right.
Have you been watching The X-Files again, Latimer?
Reading them, Mum.
But they're not real either.
I beg to differ, Mum, and they quite clearly tell us that there is a supernatural origin to crop circles.
Not aliens.
No, Mum. Freak weather events.
Hmm.
Caused by aliens.
Oh, there's only one way to answer this.
I do hope you're not declaring a thumb war, Mum.
No, Latimer, I'll never make that mistake again. I have a much better plan. To the time machine!
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't neglected to tend the tree that holds the demons in check. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, we're in a field in southern England, but at least the countryside is beautiful and the weather is clement. We've set up a table at the edge of a field in which we know a crop circle was created some years ago.
You mean within the next hour, Mum?
Yes, yes. We've brought plenty of picnic rugs for everyone, so do make yourselves comfortable and enjoy the sunset as we take tea.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but your guest has arrived, a Miss Charlie Jane Anders.
Oh, splendid. Let's see her calling card.
I think it's a calling card, but there isn't anything written on it. Most bohemian.
Oh, it's a hologram of a cyborg fairy spreading nanotech pixie dust. Well, what more do you need? Send her over, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Charlie Jane Anders is the editor-in-chief of io9.com and the author of All the Birds in the Sky. Her stories have appeared in many publications, including Asimov's Science Fiction, Tor.com, Lightspeed, and several anthologies. Her novelette, 6 Months, 3 Days, won a Hugo Award.
Ms. Charlie Jane Anders, Mum.
Hello, Charlie Jane. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It may just be a nice field in the middle of the countryside, but at least we have a table and some napkins and a doily. We have civilization with us.
Yes, that's absolutely all you need, especially if there's a doily. Doily are so important.
They really are. Would you care for some tea?
Love some, thank you.
How do you take your tea?
I guess black, one sugar.
Marvellous. I'll pour. And I was wondering if you would like a slice of blueberry buckle.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Yes, thank you.
I'm very excited because I've never had this cake before. It's a new one that Latimer's made. Have you had it before?
No, I haven't. It sounds terrific, though.
It's apparently a kind of a single layer blueberry kind of coffee cake with like a crumbly streusel topping. So... I just wanted to check, you're not allergic to chickens, are you?
You know, depending on if one's dancing with them or what, I think I'm good. I think chickens and I get along most splendidly.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, they've got a little area over there that we've penned off in the field, so they're not too close anyway. In my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Well, I've brought a parasol. And it's a mysterious parasol that has strange swirling patterns on them that I wouldn't advise staring at for too long. They change when you're not looking, but sometimes if you stare too much, one can be enticed into a state of madness.
Oh my goodness! A dangerous, perilous parasol. I love it. It's one of those things I haven't got. You know, I've wanted a parasol for so long, but I've never been able to find the right one. Where did you get yours?
It was given to me by a friend.
Ah, are they a mysterious, dangerous friend?
I think you could say that, yes. I think that is fair to say.
We have been able to come to this field today because we've used a time machine. I was wondering if you had a time machine at your disposal, which famous historical mystery would you most like to investigate?
Oh my goodness, that's a good question. Actually, I'm not sure. I guess, you know, I'd like to meet Richard II and find out what happened to the princes in the tower. That would be...
Yes! That would be great. Do you have a personal theory already?
No, I don't. That's what makes it so exciting.
I would love to do that, and I would love to find out about what happened on the Marie Celeste.
Yes. Oh, that would be lovely.
Unless something awful happened, and I wouldn't want to be involved in it, but I would just kind of like to see. But then I guess if you went back and found out what happened to the princes in the tower, would you be tempted to save them?
Well, I wouldn't want to change the course of history, so I suppose not. I would just, you know, I would just sort of document it all so that the proper people could be brought to justice later, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yes. I would at least set the record straight.
Yes. So, you're the chief editor of IO9. Am I right in thinking that you founded IO9?
Well, IO9 was really started by Annalie Newitz, my partner in crime and partner in all things, really, who was approached by Nick Denton to start a site about science fiction and futurism. And she had the idea of sort of bringing science into it and making it kind of the intersection of science and science fiction a little bit more. And she was the one who wanted to bring me into it because we had worked together on a magazine previously and a few other projects. And you know, it just sort of worked out that I was able to join the project before the site even started appearing. And that was really, really fun. So I did get to be sort of one of the founders of IO9, but not sort of the founder.
Fantastic. I was wondering what it's like being chief editor of a site which is so massively popular, because when you start out with your own stuff online, it's like the people that you reach out to, and it feels like a kind of a safe kind of little network of your own. And then as you increase in profile, more and more people come to you that may not necessarily be the kind of people that you hunt out. And when you get to like IO9 levels of popularity, everybody piles in. Does that bring challenges with it?
Yeah, it does bring some challenges. I mean, we weren't really sure when we launched it how popular it was going to be. We sort of thought, you know, the day that we pulled the trigger on it, we thought, well, this could just, you know, be an epic failure, or, you know, we'll see what happens. And I've been, you know, for eternally sort of pleasantly surprised by how much people have embraced it. And, you know, it does mean that you have to be more careful what you say, because you're speaking to, you know, a broad audience, a lot of whom don't share your own ideas or preconceptions or private language or whatever. But at the same time, you know, I think that the largeness and kind of anonymity of the audience in a way makes it in some ways actually safer, because it's not as niche and it's not as much that you're talking to one very specific group of people that you know personally who have very specific expectations of you. It's more just that you're putting stuff out there in a sort of general way, and you just have to be aware that lots of people will interpret it lots of different ways, and you have to sort of be okay with that, and both learn to kind of avoid some of the biggest unintended hot buttons. I mean, if you're pushing a hot button on purpose, that's fair enough, but the biggest unintended hot buttons, and also learn to sort of, you know, grow a thick skin about it, I guess, if people do get upset.
I don't think I would be brave enough.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I find it quite interesting when I meet people who are involved in kind of reviewing and being authors as well. Do you find that now that you're All the Birds in the Sky has really taken off and you're kind of present as an author in a big way alongside being an editor of a site, has that created any kind of tension within you?
Not so far. I mean, I'm a little bit concerned about how I'm going to balance that going forward, because, you know, I mean, I was writing science fiction as an aspiring author the whole time I was doing IO9. I've considered science fiction writing my real career since the early 2000s, at least. So it's always been a thing where I knew that in the back of my mind that I was really trying to break in as a science fiction writer. And for several years, that was sort of more academic, because I was only achieving a little bit of success with it. But I think that, you know, there's a long tradition of people who are both writers and critics, or both, you know, authors and journalists. And I think that it's just a question of being kind of a little bit more aware of where the two things rub up against each other, and just sort of not sort of blundering into things. It's sort of like what I said before. It's about just sort of knowing where the rocks are and trying to avoid them unless you actually know what you're doing. You know, I've always tried to sort of be sensitive to the fact that I'm both an author and a critic or journalist, and that I want to, you know, that I want to keep both of those things intact as much as I can. And I think a lot of book authors write book reviews. I think that if you look at the New York Times or something, all of the reviews in there are written by people who've written their own books.
Yeah, that's true. Fair enough. So if you could own any spaceship from any science fiction book, TV series, films, gaming, whatever platform, which spaceship would it be and why?
Oh, I mean, I think I'd like the Liberator from Blake 7.
Ooh.
Such a cool spaceship. And it can actually, it's like the most advanced ship in the galaxy that it's in. And it's got that cool sort of slightly sarcastic computer. And if you're lucky, it comes with that other, even more sarcastic computer, Orak. And they can sort of argue with each other. I don't know. I just think the Liberator would be like the most fun to fly around in.
Excellent. Now, you organize something called Writers with Drinks in San Francisco.
That's right.
I was really interested to read that you make up weird fictional bios for your writers and performers, which I love the idea of.
Yeah.
I was wondering who you would most like to make up a weird fictional bio for you.
Oh my gosh. That's a tough one. I mean, if he was still alive, Douglas Adams, I suppose.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I'm not sure which living person. Maybe Kelly Link.
Ah, it's funny you mention that name, because not very long ago, somebody was urging me to read Kelly Link's stories.
Oh, she's incredible.
I'm writing this down on the back of this doily.
Yay.
Okay. Now, in your latest novel, All the Birds in the Sky, you play with genre boundaries. And I was wondering if you feel that the boundaries between genre are more a tool for marketers than for writers these days. Are we just leaving them behind or just kind of ignoring them and doing what we want? Are they only useful to marketers and obviously readers for finding what they want to read? Are they still useful for us?
I mean, I think that they're definitely useful for readers. I think that if a reader really likes, you know, Regency romances and they just want to read Regency romances, there's no reason that they shouldn't just read Regency romances. I don't think there's any requirement that readers be sort of genre omnivorous or that they read all sorts of sort of Pynchon-esque meta, you know, genre spanning mashup thingies. I think that there's always going to be a tension between, it's partly a marketing thing and partly, as you say, the desires of readers to find books like the books that they like. And I think that there's always going to be a certain amount of tension between authors who want to sort of stretch out and do lots of different things and readers who want a book that fills this expectations that they might have of what they're reading. Mm-hmm. It's healthy. I think that that tension is sort of part of where the excitement comes in. And I think that it really, like anything else, if it becomes sort of a rigid draconian thing where it's like, no, your book has to have exactly 1.5 unicorns. And if it has 3 unicorns, then it's no longer unicorn punk or whatever. You know, if it gets to be sort of silly and have like lists of rules and like lists of expectations, then I don't think that's good for anybody, including readers. And I think that, you know, part of what happens with genres is that you get these feeding frenzies. Like you had the dystopian young adult feeding frenzy after Hunger Games, where everybody was writing dystopian young adult novels. And it became just a bit silly. And, you know, you had at one point a sort of feeding frenzy of urban fantasy novels. And, you know, Twilight led to an explosion of paranormal romance, that there was a lot of inferior Twilight ripoffs. And I think that, you know, those sorts of things, anytime people are writing a genre or a subgenre simply because that's what the market is demanding, that often leads to works that maybe aren't as interesting in some ways. Although then you occasionally get, like, you know, you'll get 1,000 new dystopian YA books, and one of them will just randomly be super interesting and offbeat and doing something really new and wild. And maybe that wild, different dystopian YA book wouldn't have gotten published if there hadn't been the reading frenzy. Basically, what it really comes down to, I think, is the tension between, you know, book publishing as a business, creating a product that people want to buy, versus some notion of you know, artistic freedom or whatever, which I don't really ever want to be precious about, like, my sacred artistic, you know, vision or whatever. I'm pretty much happy to write anything that is going to be fun and is going to get people interested. But at the same time, I think that it's only when things become too much, like, we need 1 million more of these widgets, that I sort of start to, my eyes start to glaze over a little bit.
Yes. When I have a friend over for tea, I like to ask on the Twitters if there are any questions that people who can't be present with us in this lovely, beautiful field would ask if they were able to be here. And there were lots, so I had to pick out the ones that I wanted to ask the most, because that's the delicious power that one has as the interviewer. So there was one from somebody called Valerie, who would like to ask, do you find it hard to transition between working on non-fiction, short fiction, and novels?
I mean, short fiction and novels, it's more or less the same process. It's the same sort of part of my brain or whatever. I do kind of enforce a somewhat rigid boundary between the non-fiction writing and the fiction writing, which I've done for years, even before I was doing IO9. The thing I will do is I will, when I'm done with my non-fiction work for the day, I take a really long walk and end up in a cafe somewhere, and then just sort of stare at my computer for a few hours, or at least an hour if there's a lot of evening plans, and work on my fiction, and then I take another long walk coming home. So it sort of clears my head a little bit, and sitting in a cafe kind of enforces a slightly different, you know, setting and different feeling than if I'm at home. So that's sort of how I keep them somewhat separated out. There's no easy solution, but I find that as long as I don't just sort of mush them together, I can actually keep the two parts of my brain happy, I guess.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I find walking is just such a lovely way to ease into writing fiction, that there is something about physically moving. And I don't know if it's the same for you as well, but I find traveling on trains is a similar kind of thing, that it kind of loosens something up to write creatively.
Oh yeah, I love trains. I love taking the train. I miss when I lived in the UK. The trains were lovely there. Amtrak in the United States isn't quite as nice, but it can be nice, actually. I like the Acela train.
Another question that came over Twitter from a lovely chap called Didi, and he's asked, you've published a novel to resounding critical success. Does it make work on your next novel easier or harder?
That's a really interesting question. And actually, I haven't been thinking about the resounding critical success part, because I'm like trying to like not read too many reviews and worry too much about it, because it's just, that's a way to go insane. But, the thing that's interesting is I started work on my next novel, you know, a year and a half ago. And at the time, I had this idea that I should make it as different from All the Birds in the Sky as I possibly could, both in subject matter and in sort of tone and style, partly because if All the Birds in the Sky was a horrible disaster and everybody hated it, I could come out with something totally different and, be like, but look, here's something completely different. And if All the Birds in the Sky miraculously did well, I could be like, well, here's me proving that I'm versatile or whatever. And, now I think that it's interesting, because if I was starting work on my next novel now, having heard from various people that they really liked All the Birds in the Sky, I think that I would feel more of a sense that I should make my next novel more similar to All the Birds in the Sky, because people actually liked it. And I'm feeling like, oh, maybe I should have been working on a novel that was actually in the same vein as All the Birds in the Sky. But then I actually think that I'm kind of glad that I sort of locked myself into this plan of doing something completely different, because I sidestepped the temptation, such as it is, to try and, follow up All the Birds in the Sky with another All the Birds in the Sky. I've already kind of locked myself into this other plan. And so I can just sort of ignore that and do something completely new and different, and hope that people don't say, well, this was a horribly disappointing follow-up. I mean, that can happen anyway.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? You never know how people are going to react. So,
so true.
Yeah. I'm kind of starting to think now that the only thing you can do is actually write what you are burning to write, because everything else is just kind of a false economy in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's like, it gets back to the thing about business versus, the creative aspect. And I think that, it's a balance. And I actually think that if you go too far in either direction towards like the, I'm just going to write whatever I think people will buy direction, versus the I'm going to listen to my muse and create a timeless work of art that, is following my own brilliant vision because I am a super genius, mwahahahaha thing. I think either one of them is potentially a bad extreme to go to, because really the best thing is a balance. I think that, part of what I was going to say before about genres is that you don't write in isolation. And you write to be read. At least I write to be read. I don't write books just to please myself. And I don't think of myself as just sort of writing a book and putting it on a shelf and like being satisfied that I wrote a book. And like some people do. I know people who are like, I just write to please myself. And I know people who've written a dozen books that they've never let anybody else read because they just wanted to write them and they wanted to have written them and they were happy to have written the book and they didn't care if anybody read it. And that was not the point for them. To me, the point is to be read and the point is to have a dialogue with readers. And when I write a book, I have a reader in my head. And, you know, depending on what the book is and how deranged I'm feeling, the reader in my head might be kind of a strange person. But there's actually a person that I'm imagining reading my book that I'm kind of having a dialogue with that I'm like, okay, so they know this and they know this. How are they going to respond when I reveal this piece of information? You know, I think that a lot of what I like about fiction writing is that sense of a dialogue. And it's a very different kind of dialogue than when you're blogging, where you write something and then 5 minutes later, you hit publish and then the comments just come pouring in and, you know, the entire universe wants to tell you that you're an idiot. If you write a novel, you have to wait up to 2 or 3 years for people to tell you that you're an idiot and, you know, like delayed gratification. But, you know, I do think of it as a dialogue and I do think that part of that is that you want to write things that people are interested in reading. You want to write things that, you know, if you have a kernel of something that you're trying to write about, you want to wrap that in a wrapper that is going to be interesting to people. You know, I don't think that there's some hard dichotomy between pure artistic creation on the one side and just being a hack or whatever on the other. I think it's sort of a blend and it's a bit of a continuum. And I'm sort of happiest in the middle.
Yeah, and I think it's also something that you kind of think more about as your career goes on, because this is actually very similar to a conversation I was having with my husband last night about the whole balance between writing to what you think the market might like and writing what you're burning to write. And I was saying to him that if I woke up one morning and said, look, darling, I must write a 500,000 word epic in middle English because this is the best way to tell this story, that, you know, that would be really, really stupid in terms of me paying my mortgage. And, you know, that's not a good career decision. So I would never let myself do that, no matter how tempted I was. So I think you're right that you always have a little, like a check at the back of your mind of, okay, well, I'm really captivated by this idea, but will anyone else in the universe be interested in anything like this whatsoever?
Yeah. You know, I mean, what I always get back to it also is, you know, you have your epic that you want to write in middle English. What is it about that captivates you, and how can you, like, what's the core or the kernel of that idea that you're captivated by, and how can you perhaps reconceive it in another way that, you know, is not as abstruse?
Yeah, I agree. And I've been slightly obsessed with David Bowie interviews for obvious reasons lately. And I was very interested to read him talking in one about how the times in his career where he tried to create something that he thought people would like were his least successful. But the things that he wanted, that he just kind of had to do and decided to go and do, were his most successful, that came from him rather than his idea of what people might like. Which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No. I mean, although then you've got Let's Dance, which I think was a pure, like, you know, have a hit record, and I think that was very calculated.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in a career that spans so many albums and so many years, and so many of those years where, by his own admission, he was doing a hell of a lot of drugs. You know, how well is he going to remember all of the different decisions? Yeah. So I've got one last question that came from the Twitters, from the lovely Hisham. And he asked, if you were trapped in a bunker with only reruns of a TV show for company for 6 months, which show would you choose?
I mean, it would obviously be Doctor Who. I mean, that's pretty much guaranteed because, A, there's a lot of it. And B, I pretty much spend my life trapped in a bunker watching Doctor Who reruns anyway. I mean, that's what I already do with my life. So it would be a continuation of my life as it is now.
Marvelous. I think that there were several people who asked on Twitter, and something I would like to know about is what you have that's coming up in the future, like next novels and things. Because obviously, All the Birds in the Sky is quite recent. It's only, what, a month or two old?
Yeah, it came out almost exactly a month ago.
So I guess it's pretty early to talk about your next novel.
Yeah, I mean, all I can really say about my next novel is it's sort of more pure science fiction. It's set in the future on another planet. Yeah, that's about all I can say. And I've got short stories that I'm working on. I've got some stories that are coming out in anthologies that I'm not even sure if they've been announced yet. I think, the fairy tale anthology has been announced. I think it's called The Starlit Wood. That's being edited by Nava Wolf and Dominique Parisienne.
Oh, wow.
It's retellings of fairy tales. It's like Grimm and other fairy tales sort of retold by authors and as like fantasy and science fiction stories.
I'm so envious.
It comes out in October. And, you know, it's funny because they asked me which classic fairy tale would you like to reimagine? And I was immediately like, because they'd already gotten a bunch of authors for the book, I was like, oh, please tell me that nobody's taken the bird, the sausage, and the mouse yet. And they were like, don't worry, nobody's taken that story. Because I just thought that would be the first one anybody would want. I mean, obviously. But luckily, I was the first person to ask for that story. So I got it. And I was able to sort of do some very strange things with it.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me what you would consider to be the theme tune of your life so that I can ask the chickens over there if they will sing it for us.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to go with Shining Star by Earth, Wind & Fire.
Ooh, Shining Star. Is this one of those songs where if I heard it, I would suddenly go, oh, it's
probably,
that one.
Probably. It's featured in the first few moments of the first episode of Glee. So it's a lot of people have heard it pretty recently.
Okay, well, let's see if the chickens know it. They haven't ever met a song they didn't know, so I'm very confident here. So, little chickens, could you sing Shining Star by Earth, Wind and Fire for Charlie Jane, please? There they go.
Oh, lovely. Oh, good. You absolutely nailed it. Good job, chickens.
Yeah, they are extraordinarily talented.
Yeah, no, it's appropriate because Maurice White, the lead singer of Earth, Wind & Fire, just died, and he was an incredible inspiration. He was a brilliant musician.
Oh, there are far too many amazing people that we're losing this year.
I know, it's horrible.
It is absolutely awful. Oh, well, let's check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh, no.
So I'm afraid there's no more tea, but all that leaves for me to do is to thank you so much for dropping in to take tea with me today. It's been such a joy to be able to sit down and have a nice chat with you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So all you need to do is just follow Latimer. He'll guide you over the corner of the field so you don't accidentally get squished by people making a crop circle, because it's due to happen any minute, but he'll guide you in the direction to keep you out of harm's way.
Lovely.
Well, I hope I'll see you again at some point, hopefully, if I'll be able to get back to America to another convention. But in the meantime, take care and best of luck with All the Birds in the Sky and stories and awesomeness.
Yay, thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
This way, Mom.
Oh, look, Latimer, look who's coming. Farmers on their way to make the crop circle.
They're very odd-looking farmers.
That's very rude, Latimer.
That one has three legs, Mum.
Well, in some of these rural communities... No, wait, three legs? That isn't right.
They don't appear very happy to see Miss Anders there.
No, I think they always look like that. And anyway, they're ignoring Charlie Jane. If anything, they're avoiding her. I wonder why. Oh, what's that?
I believe it's a spaceship, Mum. An alien spaceship. On its way to make the crop circle.
Oh, that light is so bright. But it's not making a crop circle, it's lifting Charlie Jane off the ground.
Ah, yes, a classic abduction.
Oh, she looks furious. Is she saying something?
I believe she's addressing them in their own language. Goodness me. I'm not sure there was any call for that.
Oh, do you speak that language?
I have a passing understanding of it, Mum. Oh, it appears they already know each other.
Ah, that's why they're putting her down again. They've realized she's not a threat. Oh, do you think they might see us as a threat, Latimer?
Perhaps it's best not to find out.
Pack the tea things quickly. While Latimer takes care of that, I'd like to raise my teacup to Diane Goodwin and Dan Findlay Robinson, the newest members to join the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and find out how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but someone has left a letter on the table for you.
One of the aliens?
I'm not sure, ma'am. There are a few clues on the envelope.
Well, let me have a look. To Emma, the supposed lady time traveller. So you've travelled back to solve a mystery, but this one is small fry. I am far superior at solving historical mysteries, and I am going to prove it. Solve the following riddle to discover where a real challenge can be found. For a simple shape I have confounded many, something inside me is really deadly. I can't be seen, but I have been drawn. I've been around since before you were born. What am I? Lady Time Traveller? Right. Well, I'm sure between us and our lovely listeners we'll work out this riddle.
Are you really going to waste your time pandering to this individual?
I'm going to do more than that, Latimer. I'm going to solve this riddle, and then I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. Now, let's go before the aliens notice us.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes, and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.
Just for the record, ma'am, it was aliens that made the crop circle. So I was right.
Yes, but you said it was freak weather activity caused by aliens, so you're wrong. And they were dressed as farmers, and I said it was farmers, so technically I'm right.
Aliens.
Farmers.
Aliens.
Farmers.
Aliens.
Farmers.
Aliens.
Farmers.